has no set idea of his own. He is to serve truth, not to define it. When he defines it, he defiles it. Therefore, he cannot say this road leads to it or that road leads to it. And this was the same burden that Jesus had against the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Namely, that they regarded themselves as peculiarly qualified in spiritual matters. And Jesus called them hypocrites. Because the individual who sets up his own standard denies the right of the universe to establish true standard. Of course, the universe fails to notice this slight indiscretion and continues to exercise its own standard. And the individual finds himself locked in conflict with reality instead of moving toward it. Reality is not to be discovered as the expected. It is to be experienced as it is, as a wonder unknown that cometh in the night, and the time or the hour no man knoweth. Therefore, we cannot say, when I have achieved this, I have truth. If I study that, I shall be enlightened. If I follow this master, I shall be illumined. It might happen from any one of those causes. But the moment anyone says, by this it will happen, some very subtle law of spiritual value is destroyed. And these subtle laws become more real than the grosser laws we know when we begin to function in a very attenuated and subtle sphere of consciousness. So it is not that Buddha intends for us to imply a total disregard for this or total disregard for that, but rather to take the same attitude that he took with the Brahmins. If a wise man says there is a God, I agree with him. If the wise man says there is no God, I agree with him. Because actually, the moment we lock ourselves in disagreement with the wise man, we become about as stupid as any human being can be. Because we can only do this on one assumption, that we know more than he does. And we end up by trying to affirm that we know more than God does. And this always ends in embarrassment. Therefore, we cannot, with the faculties that we possess, say this or that. All we can do is to seek. To seek with everything we have for the good that surpasseth understanding. And if we lock our minds in this religion or in that religion, then we are in trouble. It is not that the religion may be wrong, nor is it true that the religion will not lead us there. But the moment we say this and no other will lead us there or lead me there, we are then dogmatizing over something we do not understand. And we are not illumined, but heavily creed-bound with certain dogmas that are forever getting in the way of our own growth. Therefore, we notice in the world several kinds of people. People who are very sure of everything and usually very uncomfortable, unhappy, unadjusted. The individual who passes judgment continuously is one who has experienced little. The more we become acquainted with value, the less certain we become of anything except the ultimate fact of value. If we walk one path, it is the only path. But if we sincerely walk two paths, then there are two paths. We have experienced them. And if with a certain charity of consciousness, we walk one path and wish well to another man who is walking another path nearby, then we share in a common understanding. But all paths walked by the righteous lead to righteousness. And it is not the path, but the one who walks it, that determines whether or not the goal shall be achieved. The worst religion in the world can lead the good man to heaven, because it cannot corrupt the good man. And if it corrupts him or corrupts anyone, it is because they are weak, not because they are good. The true person cannot be deceived, because he will take any symbol that is presented to him and interpret it in the term of truth. On the other hand, the truest symbol in the world presented to the person who does not have this understanding cannot reveal to him the fact. It is a very subtle thing, but it is something that every truth seeker has to work with in his own experience. This experience of realizing that reality is everywhere, and that the good man is ever near to it, regardless of what he believes. And the person who has bound himself by intellectual limitations is among the furthest from it. He is not as near as the simple aborigine or the small child, because these others, the child and the aborigine, have directness, have simplicity, and have that kind of insight which is denied the person who has destroyed his own insight by artificial sophistication. So I think the lesson that Buddha teaches us on that point is very worthwhile, and has much to do with the achievement of well-being. Now, there is another section in here which I also think is very important, but we pass over it rather lightly, and therefore I'd like to bring out certain additional material in relation to it. We mention in here the four caste systems as they were taught and understood in India. And we divide for this purpose of this meditation study existence as we know it into four lokas, or regions, guarded over by the four kings of the corners of the world that are called the lokapalas. These four regions are called the sacerdotal sphere, the administrative sphere, the economic sphere, and the sphere of crafts and trades. Now, these are the four castes of Hinduism. And this division, whether we recognize it or not, is not an arbitrary bit of Hindu theology. It is an obvious and inevitable division of society. A society which divides instinctively into levels. Now, the growth of man in the course of ages has gradually resulted in the loss of clear lines of demarcations between these levels. There was a time when a man was born into one of these castes, and in this he remained as long as he lived, and his sons and their sons after him. But with the passing of time, the general elevation of the state of man has resulted in the human being inhabiting two or more of these castes simultaneously. He has not necessarily broken through the caste system, but he has achieved a status which enables him to be in more than one sphere of activity at one time. And also, to go back to the statement that we first made prior to this, namely, these four states or conditions used to have very arbitrary religious and philosophical meanings. And it was assumed that only the Brahmin or the administrator could hope to attain to enlightenment. Buddha broke through this barrier with a tremendous crash in the 6th century B.C. And while the times and circumstances have shifted in Asia, the whole world has now also broken through this concept, and has come to the final conclusion that due to the natural circumstances of living, average persons are arranged in these groups but that these groups are no longer walls or barriers. They are roads and bridges leading to a certain distinct and purposeful end. Perhaps the one of the most interesting points, for instance, is this consideration of the fourth state, class, caste, or sphere, which we mention here as the sphere of the crafts and trades, involving labor, production, also the agriculturist, the craftsman, the mechanic, and these phases of human life. Now, this is no longer what it used to be. Up to the 17th century of the Christian era in Europe, there was no difference in the words which now stand for artist and artisan. The word artist, as we know it today, did not exist. That word is less than 300 years old, as having any meaning apart from artisan. In other words, a man who was an artisan might put a good sole on a pair of shoes. In the 16th century, he could be indiscriminately referred to as either an artisan or an artist. We had no division between these. In the development of folk arts and folk crafts today, the same situation presents itself. Some of our most marvelous creative activity today is on the level of crafts and arts, rather than on the level of the great superior forms of knowledge that were once regarded as sublime. We are not at all sure today that there is any essential difference in art value between a little cup that was made by the tens of thousands by a Korean potter and the finest piece of Haviland china that you can buy. In fact, in the Orient and among some European collectors, you can buy the most beautiful piece of Haviland china, $500 or $1,000. Then you're really paying a high price for it. But for a little old crude Korean bowl that is almost shapeless and has just a little glaze dripping down one side, you may have to pay $50,000. The Haviland china was designed by an artist. The bowl was made by an artisan. And at the present time, the work of the artisan is worth 100 times the work of the artist. He is the greater artist. So therefore, you are not sure just what you're dealing with. And in this problem of the dividing of man into various levels, we come to this important philosophical fragment of insight, which I think we should know. Man is today largely a divided personality. In China, the idea of the transcendent being, multiplying itself, as described in this book, meant that, as in the story of Buddha, that when the time came for the illumination of the world, Buddha multiplied himself and appeared simultaneously in the 33 worlds. By an extension of himself, therefore, he was present in the highest regions of the abstract universe and at the same time in the lowest, densest, and most troubled regions of Avicii or hell. He was immediately present everywhere by this mystery of the transcendent being. And it is also referred in legend, at least, that during the so-called 3 days in the grave, Jesus went down into the underworld to relieve the souls of the lost. This is still celebrated as part of the church rituals. So here we have man now, no longer a separate being, and no longer needing adjustment merely upon one level or plane, but finding it increasingly necessary to render unto Caesar those things which are Caesar's in each of the spheres of his life. So today we have in the human being all of these elements combined in one. We have man the priest. We have man in this capacity as the great guardian of his own soul. We have man the administrator. Here, by wisdom and understanding, by learning and knowledge. He must lead the course of his own life. He must make the rational decisions. He must also engage with others in the common problems of leadership and administration. Then we have man as the worker, in the sense of the economist. We have the man who must make a living, who must buy and sell, must exchange commodities, must maintain the elaborate and involved structure of what we call the financial patterns under which we live. And even if these patterns should change sometime, still some pattern will be there, requiring adjustment to the problems of mutual cooperation and effort for mutual survival. Then we have man, the craftsman, the laborer, the builder, who must create in various ways all the things which he needs, either directly or indirectly. He must also have the creative instincts of making a better world. Here is your agriculturist who must feed the world. Here are all the various lines of activity. And in symbolism, they can be in one person. They can represent the levels of his own nature. And as so representing these levels, they terminate by causing a person to be more than one individual. He is bound together by a total consciousness, which to a measure determines the degree of relationship of all of these spheres of action to his own nature. But in his meditation and in his reflections, and in his practice of mystical disciplines, he cannot function solely on one level. If he does, he accomplishes a discord or a division within himself. He must find the synthesizing agent of his own understanding, and he must adjust himself properly, reasonably, and normally upon all levels. The individual who devotes his life to meditation and someone else has to work to supply him with bread is not the true person. He is not the true disciple. The individual who does not assume all of the reasonable duties which are involved in life, but thinks of spirituality as an evasion of these duties, or an escape from them, or that by holiness he shall escape the need for these adjustments. This person is following, of course, the old ascetic ideas of ancient Hinduism and even primitive Christianity. But he is not following the doctrine of the Pure Land. He is not following this concept that gradually took over, that the person has to bring all of himself into a kind of normal or proper integration. Integration must therefore be a fulfillment of the person rather than an effort of the person to escape from level to level, to leave behind that which is unpleasant or uncomfortable in some region where adjustment has not been attained. If the person neglects his administrative faculties, he is in trouble. If, however, in the cause of administration, he neglects his spiritual values, he is also in trouble. If in his search for inner understanding he ignores his economic responsibilities, he not only creates a problem for himself, but loses the respect of his fellow men. And if in the various processes in which he is concerned, he does not make creative contribution, if he does not in some way or other make two blades of grass grow where one grew before, he is also being unfair to his world, and he is failing in that proper and orderly progress by means of which his nature will ultimately be brought to quietude. The end, of course, is quietude. And this quietude cannot come if the four unreconciled castes are constantly at war with each other. In the old Hindu system, the sudra, or the slave, was always resenting his superiors in class. The Brahmin was looking down upon the merchant. The warrior was looking down upon the agriculturist. And, of course, the agriculturist and the lower type of mechanic had no direction to look except up, and there he saw nothing but his superiors. This was not a proper attitude. Yet it is an attitude that can happen to us, not in just the same way, perhaps, but just as seriously. For all these old stories are symbolic accounts of values which have to be experienced and with which we must become gradually informed. The human being also, by natural instinct, has the attributes of the four castes. Now, instinct cannot be frustrated. Instinct must be unfolded until man discovers that the truth instinct is the energy behind all other instincts. Until he finds that out, he has not achieved. Therefore, it is not the frustration of instinct, but the normalization of it, by which, under proper condition, all instincts lead to that which is good, that which is proper, that which is next. Of course, one of our problems is that instincts may seem too slow for us. They only show us the next thing when what we want is 10 jumps ahead. This is, of course, unfortunate because we cannot achieve unless we take each step. The effort to escape or to jump across vast intervals without thoroughly grounding ourselves as we proceed will lead to the most dangerous spiritual accidents. Thus, the problem of the person is that he has a kind of fourfold personality, the elements of which must all find their own peace. The man who works with his hands or finds this part of his outlet must find peace in this work. He must find in it the gradual experiencing of universals. When he weaves or draws or paints or carves or whittles, he is working toward universal creative expression. And as he finds the laws in his crafts and arts, he becomes more and more capable of adoring the master of laws. And therefore we had the ancient cults and secret societies and orders of artisans and architects and stonecutters. These were no longer simply building houses for princes and tyrants. They were truing the stone of character for the glory of the eternal God. And as the old Essene masters of Syria felt that every time they built a house, they were bringing the sense of family and of home and of security and of value to human beings. Therefore, to build a house was an act of worship. To make a work of art is an act of worship. To produce something that is pleasant, beautiful, satisfying, these things are acts of worship. Man worships as he plants the seeds in the earth, just as much as he does before the altar of the church. And the same way in economics. And, of course, the history of the economic sphere is one of the rockiest in the entire history of man's experience. In many nations, particularly in some of the Far Eastern countries, the merchant is regarded as the lowest of all classes and has difficulty even surviving. But in the end, for some unexplained reason, the merchant ends up with everything. No matter whether he is despised or not, he ends up with the goods. He has a mysterious ability to survive. Now, merchandising we regard in many ways as a kind of parasitical way of life. But under the conditions in which we live, with the tremendous diversification of products, the need of the transportation of products and the distribution of them through incredible areas, merchandising and the whole theory of economics has taken on a basic integrity. We have to have it. Therefore, we are no longer dealing with an evil unless it is abused. And the individual engaged in these projects has also the right to pride, the right to the recognition that through the distribution of these things necessary to man, he is contributing to the well-being of man. Now, it may well be that he makes a profit so doing. But if his primary pride is in the fact that he is serving a need, he may take a reasonable profit with honor. But if his only consideration is profit, and he merely grudgingly serves the world's need, then this individual is spiritually wrong. And if this person should, by some means or circumstances, decide to become religious, he must certainly correct this basic error in himself, in his relationship to his world and his life. If he does not, he's in trouble. It does not mean that he has to give up his merchandising, but he has to revitalize the true motive behind value and have that motive first and serve that motive first with a realization that if he stands firmly upon his motive, those things which are otherwise necessary shall be added unto him. It is his motive. Is he in business because he believes that the world has a need which he must supply? If he has this basic conviction, and it is real, it will not interfere with his spiritual growth, but will advance it. But to have this conviction means that he must obey it, must vitalize it, and must sacrifice if necessary for it. But if his conviction is right, then the thing which he is doing is right. And he will then administer what he is doing honorably. The same is true in the administrative sphere or in the professions. We have the common problem that we think of so often of the doctor. If the primary motive of the doctor is the recovery of the patient, if he recognizes himself as a priest of the healing arts, and this is his primary consideration, he is entitled to what reasonable support he needs. For the workman is worthy of his hire. He is entitled to whatever is properly a reward for work well accomplished. He will be paid. It is a byproduct of work well done. But the primary motive in his own consciousness must sincerely and honorably be that he desires to devote his energy, his time, and his life to the service of the sick, that he may bring them back, if possible, to such health as may be possible by the knowledge which he possesses. His motive must be right. If it is so right, then it is also true of the diplomat, the politician, the statesman. These may advance to any condition that their honor may bring them to, so long as they do not dishonor their own honor. But that person who desires office merely for ambition, is already wrong. And if that same person should attempt some form of religious or spiritual training, he can get nowhere until he corrects his own motive. And the same in the sacerdotal sect. If the servant of God, the priest, the administrator, the minister, clergyman, if these persons have as their primary end the service of God and their fellow man, then their way is indicated, and they are entitled to that which is necessary for them to be able to supply that need as effectively and as joyously and as pleasantly as possible. But if this motive is not right, if our theologian is merely a church politician, then this individual is deprived of all religious insight by that circumstance alone. He cannot know the real. Now, we may not be chosen to such a great decision as this, but in each walk of life, in whatever we are doing, if our motive is not instinctively right, it is then instinctively wrong. Now, we can live comparatively well with a comparatively inadequate motive. We can drift along, as millions have before us, from the cradle to the grave, and our motives will be responsible only for gradual hardening of the arteries. But if in this way of life we suddenly develop a yen for religion. Suddenly we decide to be spiritual. And we begin this difficult path of trying to find out what truth is and how we could attain to it. Then these motives stand as guardians by the gate. Like the scowling lion dogs, with their strange intuition, they cannot be deceived. And the individual striving to go on is blocked entirely by the general pattern of his own inadequate motive. So the need constantly to make sure that as we dedicate ourselves to something better, that we have cleaned house, that these motives upon which so much depends have themselves been properly cleansed. For if they have not, we are in trouble. These motives, extending into many spheres of life, bring with them all that they imply, and we cannot escape them at any time. If then, to go on a little further in our book, you will find the little story here about the art dealer with the lacquer box that was made long ago by an artisan. I saw the box in Kyoto when I was there, and it had a little tray in it, and the tray rested inside the box, and you put the tray in the box, and it fitted perfectly and seemed like the upper tray of a trunk or something of that nature. It rested flush with the top of the box. But the dealer put his hand in the center of the tray and pressed down on it, and the tray went down. He lifted his hand, the tray came back up again. The tray was floating on air. The lacquer fitted so perfectly that the tray floated on the air pressure. Now, this was made a long time ago. It was made of wood. Certainly, it had been beautifully lacquered. But this wood had gone through expansion and contraction for 100 years, and still the tray fitted perfectly. And as this little man told me, and he's involved, is one of the characters that fit together to make the personality of Mr. Nakamura, this little man told me, he said, this is what we call work with insight. This is another dimension of integrity. For the way to spiritual understanding, the way to self-unfoldment, is the way of a kind of quiet dignity in which the individual is incapable of ever doing less than his best. It just doesn't appear to him conceivable that he could. The way of haste, the way of imperfect workmanship, the way of indifference to labor, the way of indifference to problem, the way of indifference to anything, the easy way, the quick way, the cheap way, these can have no place in the consciousness of this person searching for enlightenment. For if he has this at one extremity of his consciousness, he will never have integrity at the other. It's simply impossible. He can never rise out of his own compromise until inwardly he experiences the impossibility of further compromise. He must do it right. Therefore, to love God on the one hand and do a sloppy job on the other, these are incompatible. These tear the individual apart psychically. Now, it might seem that this doesn't mean too much. But as the great dragon is said to be the result of many little dragons, so the great disaster is always the result of innumerable little disasters. And the most terrible of small disasters is compromise. So the person learns that the way of self-unfoldment is a way of completeness. We are seeking to become complete. We must therefore think and live and feel with all intent that all things shall be as perfect, as beautiful, as possible, in order that In this way, we may offer a peculiar symbol, the symbol of our own dedication to value, and that this offering is the one most acceptable in the sight of the Most High. Therefore, we come to the substance of our main thought of the evening, and that is the elements which go to make up the nature of this transcendent being, which is nothing more or less than our transcendent selves. It is our self seen with honor. It is the individual who honestly and sincerely and without pride and with factual certainty can look into himself and say, here is a fellow that is really making a good try. A little dangerous to say that here's a fellow that's good, but it is perfectly permissible to say that here is someone that is sincerely and honestly making a good try. That everything possible in the life is being brought into a pattern of value, of integrity. Not for the sake of becoming spiritual, but because actually it is only this unity of value that can make a person happy, make him contented, make him able to live conveniently and comfortably with himself. This person can go to sleep with a good conscience and can wake up into a world of wonders where there are more things to be done. The person who has this attitude cannot be bored and can never find an uninteresting universe, nor can he ever dedicate his total attention to some useless and meritless purpose. We have values coming through. To waste time is to waste value. But to use time desperately is to waste time. All things must have their rightness and their properness. And out of this gradual integration on the four levels of the castes, the four levels of our own contemplative existence, extending through every phase of our activity, personal and collective, individual and universal, there gradually comes into integration nothing exceptional, because as Daruma in the Zen points out, the end of all growth is that we shall not have something exceptional, because something exceptional is like a thorn or a horn sticking out somewhere for something to stumble over. We are not seeking to be exceptional. We do not regard reality as exceptional. We would rather say the person who lives badly is exceptional. We want to take the ground that the normal is not in any way an exception, but that most people live by a law which is an exception to the normal. So what we wish to produce in the end is not a person worthy to be a god, or a person who has risen triumphantly above the consciousness of his neighbors. What we are trying to produce out of all of this is an individual of simple, normal, reasonable, orderly attitudes. One who means what he says and says what he means, and at the same time is instinctively gentle and instinctively kind. One who is able to estimate through things into the value within them and behind them. When he speaks, thinks not only of what he wants to say, but of the capacity of his listener to understand. Who achieves all things in a proper, gracious, gentle manner. This person is now no longer psychic stress-ridden. He is quiet. He is orderly. He is composed. He has achieved that integration by means of which he is in a relationship with universal life that is real. He has obeyed all things according to the law of his own being and of the law of universal being. The reward of this simple adjustment is rapport with reality. This person experiences reality. He experiences it either in meditation or through discipline, because there is no conflict to destroy it. There is no illusion to tear it up. The individual, very quietly, also experiences reality simply and humbly. He is not in the midst of some fantastic experience which he wishes to tell all his friends. The things that come upon him come quietly, as a small voice speaking in the night. The truth comes in without fanfare, without tremendous announcement of itself. The values simply operate because man permits them to operate. And when the individual ceases to be his poorest self, he becomes his divine self. He cannot train or condition or unfold or educate the transcendent being any more than he can instruct God on how to run the universe. Actually, the only thing he can do is to train, educate, and control those phases of himself by which the transcendent being is inhibited and prevented from functioning. So the individual who removes his own errors stands in the face of truth. For he is never divided by truth, from truth by anything but his own mistake, his own wrong psychological integration. But how powerful this wrong integration can be attested by the fact that it has burdened man since the beginning of known time. Man has fought for this reality since the dawn of recorded history and long before. And only a handful have found it. Because in a very few instances has the individual actually been able to break through the illusion which he has created around his own conduct. He has not been able to be simple. He has not been able to be straight. He has not been able to be kind. He has not been able to get selfishness, self-purpose, and self-will out of the compound of his own nature. And he has suffered and died from these since the dawn of things. But it is not necessary that it be so. Because for each individual, there must be ultimately this awakening. This awakening into the beauty of the individual who is the gardener because he simply loves the roses. That there is no other value involved, that is which is what he wants to be. And if his desire to be real is greater than his desire to be something that is not real, he will achieve. And his achievement will be the beginning of all of the good things which he seeks. It is wrong to seek the good things first. The scripture tells us the correct order beyond doubt. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all these other things shall be added unto you. Most people start seeking for all the other things first. Therefore, the kingdom of righteousness is not experienced. It's never found. But if man seeks that first which is first, the result of this direct, simple achievement is that everything else that is necessary is immediately there. But if sought for its own sake, these other things, or this other thing, will never actually be found. The transcendent being is therefore actually the archetypal integration, the normalcy, the quiet meditating figure seated in the heart, which by its own extension can move itself, not only into any part of the body, but into any part of the mind and the soul, the emotions, the consciousness, that this transcendent nature is what it is simply because it transcends that which is less than itself. And this transcending means that by value and power and purpose and substance, it is superior. And this superior being is always represented in one of these quiet postures. The superior being never waves a flag, never rides off in triumph, never receives the plaudits of the multitude. The superior being never senses itself as giving orders and announcing its decisions or passing judgments or criticizing or condemning. The transcendent being is always represented in this highly meditative, highly mystical relationship with life. It is that which exists only in its own nature. It exists in the supreme quietude of things. Not a quietude from sound alone, but a quietude from stress. When so experienced within, it is a self made available. It is the northern Buddhistic idea of the redeemed self. It is not the final nirvanic nature, because nirvana and the paranirvana go far beyond this point. But this is the self that merits heaven. This is the self for which the Western paradise of Amitabha was brought into existence. This is the self that shall abide in the blessed regions of Sukhravati. Here is the self that goes on to peace, to rest, and to hope. Now, Buddha, as many of the other sages, pointed out, much as Plato did, that this land of the blessed, to which the individual goes if he has led the good life, may or not be a place at all. The land of the blessed could be right here where he lives now. The land of the blessed could be the old world of contention that he once could get nowhere with. The land of the blessed is simply all things seen through the eye of order. It is the doubt and the fear and the hurt taken out of every situation. And when these things are taken out, nothing remains except value. And this value is lesson or learning or experience, all of them blessed qualities. So the land of the blessed is simply anywhere where a person who is at peace with himself finds himself. Because no condition can take this away from him. The universe is blessed to those who have beheld its purpose. Those who know the reason for things, quietly, gently, and lovingly bow to that reason and give thanks. It is the one who does not know that forever fights and struggles and dies in the desperate effort to live. So the quiet nature of the transcendent being views all life, whether in this region or any other region, with the moderate contemplation, which is, however, not cold and not detached. Much has been said concerning how the transcendent nature shall view that which it once experienced in pain, or in turn shall view that which it shall experience in joy. Shall the transcendent nature say, "Oh, goody, goody"? Shall the transcendent nature give thanks? There is the story of the good soul, the transcendent nature, that was rewarded after death by being transported into the paradise of Indra. After this good being, who had been a good king and ruled his people wisely and lovingly, had remained in the paradise of Indra for some time, enjoying everything, he said to himself, "My, I must have been a good king to deserve this," and instantly he fell into the lowest regions of perdition. So that the mind again determines the mystery of the transcendent being. According to the esoteric metaphysics relating to this, the consciousness of the transcendent being to life, to that which it has known, to that which it hopes to know, is not cold, It is not viewing all things as some gray dream. It is not giving thanks that at last it is free. It is not even hoping for freedom. It is simply experiencing a strange, quiet warmth, which Buddha refers to as compassion. He refers to it as a kind of love emotion, which is not an ardency such as we know it, but is the quiet love of truth, the love of reality, the joy of the parent beholding joy in the eyes of the child. It is the simple directness. Behold, it is good. And in this directness, a prayerful faith, a constant internal recognition that is always warm and always wonderful, because to the true truth seeker who has found the transcendent being, all things are forever wonderful. Wonderful simply because the mystery of the divine purpose and of the divine nature, this mystery goes on and on, and everywhere it is wonderful if we have the eyes to see and the hearts to understand. If we do not, it is all terrible. So the transcendent being that has found peace has also found the wonder of the small child that, opening its eyes into a new world, sees everything wonderful, filled with hope and aspiration, no longer of immaturity, but still of childlikeness. The child that accepts with gladness the reality and goes on, fully convinced that it is being properly and definitely guided in a universe in which there are no mistakes, no errors, and no deceits. All these things have to come. They come slowly and gradually and wonderfully. But this great journey, as Buddha says, begins with the first faltering step. And each person who wishes to escape from the smallness that hurts him must gradually achieve the greatness which sets him free. And this greatness is this greatness of simple, direct acceptances and dedications that are so natural, so inevitable, that we only make these moves because we can't help making them. While we can stop ourselves, we have not attained. Because when the time is really right for us to embrace the truth, we do so simply because we cannot help it. It is the only thing we want to do. And this must mean that other desires less commendable have gradually been transmuted by the mysteries and processes of life. Thus we gradually build a new self, a self which can be free from body and inhabited, a self which can ride upon the gay birds of heaven like the Taoist immortals, a self that in the body still is free, and that yet free is forever true to the needs of the body which it occupies. A soul free of life, but ever mindful of life. A soul that inhabits space, but can at the same time lovingly comprehend the mystery of time. For that which we grow out of, we always leave behind with love. That which we try to walk out of, we may leave behind with hate. But what we outgrow, we also understand. And with infinite patience, we can regard that which was once our own, but which is no longer our own. So by degrees, this transcendent self emerges as the product of this total realization, a realization that touches, moves, changes every atom of our beings. Well, I guess the time is up, so we'll see you again a week from tomorrow.